Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why some disability advocates aren't thrilled with the new proposal aimed at making public lands more accessible and bringing Native American art to one of the country's most prestigious museums. But first, last winter, Governor Katie Hobbs ousted all of the members of the Arizona-Mexico Commission. That's a board that helps foster trade and other relationships across the border. Last summer, she refilled those positions with some members who had served on the panel in the past and some new faces. About a month ago, the governor named my next guest as the new executive director of the Arizona-Mexico Commission, Eva Masadiego. She joins me to talk more about this new role. And Eva, what to you is exciting or interesting about being in charge of this commission?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Being in charge. That is definitely how I feel. I feel a huge sense of responsibility and commitment to the commission. Before stepping into this role, I served as the director of operations for Governor Hobbs. And in that role, I managed her executive cabinet. And I led, I'm very proud to have done what I did in her office, which is leading her policy agenda, as we described the roadmap. And that was aligning the agencies and the work we're doing in state government with her policy priorities. And I did that for the first year, and I was charged, as you describe, to translate that to the Arizona-Mexico Commission. And the commission has a history of doing incredible binational work across the border in our border region. And I'm stepping in and aligning that work for the next generation.
So what are the priorities of the Hobbs administration as it relates to this commission and the relationship between Arizona and Mexico?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And it's historically has been rooted around trade and commerce. But this year we have a new board and there is a lot of passion, expertise around infrastructure and the environment, specifically as it relates to water and energy. And we have a newly imported board as of last year. And we're right now stepping into plans of what that can look like around the environment and our policy priorities around that. But then, of course, you have education and health services as well.
So I want to ask you about the environment and water issues, because, of course, there was a time when Arizona not too long ago was thinking about maybe building a desalination plant in Mexico to get some more water here. What kinds of specific things related to water and the environment might your committees and the commission as a whole be looking into?
Yeah, that is a great question. And I wish I had a very direct answer to that. But we're actually just stepping into what we call the plenary. And the plenary is our conference, as you will, where we bring agency and stakeholder leaders into the conversation of what are going to be our key projects around water and the environment and so forth. And that's actually scheduled for this fall. So we're entering those conversations. One of my goals is to prioritize. I mean, there's a lot that we can do, but we want to be very specific on what can we get done in the next 2 to 6 years. And so I wish I can tell you what we've done, but there's been focuses around water management planning, environmental quality issues facing both Arizona and Sonora region. And there is, of course, talks about, again, how do we improve the quality of life and sustainability in both states.
You mentioned education, and I want to ask about your background in that area, because you were a teacher before you entered government. How do you think that may or may not impact your new role?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm most proud of having been a public school teacher here in Phoenix. And it really, I mean, I really think educators should be running the world, because if we can run a classroom, we could definitely run the world. I was very interested in policy, and that was my introduction to education or immigration policies, working in the classroom. I wanted some real life experience of how policy was impacting my students and their families and their communities. And that experience led me into local government, leading citywide education initiatives, giving that experience. And I was then quickly known for running effective programming, running effective teams. And that's what I've been doing for the last year and a half.
So I want to ask you about the board itself, because you mentioned it's a new board. There was a bit of a surprise last year when Governor Hobbs basically got rid of the entire commission. And some of the people who are on now had been on in the past, but there are a lot of new folks on as well. You are new to this role. So I'm curious about sort of the learning curve that all of you are trying to get a hold of as you are getting up to speed and yet still trying to do the work of this commission.
Yes, I would say, and I, you know, I can't speak to the commission before this administration, but what I've been, and I don't want to say surprised, but pleasantly surprised, and what I most appreciate being 4 weeks in is the passion and expertise in the ideas. One of my first goals was meeting with 26 board members to understand who they were, what motivated and inspired them to serve on the commission, and again, understand what knowledge and passion they were bringing forward, and truly the ideas and the potential of this board to carry out these big projects. I've been saying there's not enough hours in the day to help plan this forward, and that's one of my first goals by the end of this year, is setting up a strategic plan to put those ideas forward. And But the commission, the learning curve, I think it's just a matter of turning those ideas into possibilities and projects and plans and to execute.
How would you describe right now the relationship between Arizona and Mexico, specifically Sonora, which I know is where a lot of this commission's work happens?
Yes, the Governor Hobbs has prioritized that relationship with Governor Durazo. She and him have had meetings in the past. There is a delegation that she led in Mexico City earlier this year, and so there is commitment from both the country of Mexico and Arizona to carry some of these ideas forward.
Do you find that the relationship is affected by, I guess, larger political considerations? I mean, obviously, the border and immigration have become such political issues over the last year or so. Does that impact the kind of work you do or the relationship you have with your counterparts south of the border at all?
Well, it's about focusing on the issues that, yes, focusing on the issues that are impacting both regions, right? And having those conversations. One of the reasons why this commission has done so well over 65 years is that there is a trusted collaborative relationship between both states.
So it sounds like what you're saying is you're able to sort of fall back on those relationships and the work that has been done in the past and maybe not get too caught up in the politics of the moment.
And that is about communication. And that's what we're trying to restore with our committees.
What to you does success in your role look like?
That is a great question. I ask that question daily. And right now, there's a lot that I want to do. There's a lot that I know we can do. And I've been using a sports analogy, and this is the first game of a 7 World Series. And we're in just game one. And it's about what I want to do is prioritize and drive meaningful results. And that means, you know, setting very clear projects and goals and objectives and pacing ourselves. What do we want to prioritize this year and so forth? But there's a lot of really great work ahead.
All right. That is Eva Masadiego, the new executive director of the Arizona-Mexico Commission. Eva, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I look forward to joining you in a future opportunity to be able to then describe all the great work that we've done.
Utah Senator Mike Lee is championing legislation he says will make the outdoors more equitable to everyone. It's called the Outdoor Americans with Disabilities Act, and it involves building more roads on public lands. The move comes after the Bureau of Land Management announced road closures near Moab last year, and off-roading enthusiasts sued. Now the Outdoor Americans with Disabilities Act would make the BLM and the Forest Service update travel management plans prioritizing accessibility. But some disability advocates are telling the Salt Lake Tribune it's disingenuous. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with Siren Nagakiri, founder and director of the nonprofit Disabled Hikers, more about why.
It definitely seems like just an attempt to use disability as, an excuse to reopen or build more roads. When I first saw this bill, it seemed to me like Mike Lee was upset that the BLM had closed some roads and was looking for a way to reopen them, and that disability seemed like a good reason. I mean, of course, disability is not a monolith and everyone has a variety of access needs, and I don't want to discount people who do enjoy, taking scenic drives and using all-terrain vehicles, but there is a long history of disabled people being used as political pawns and, being used to enact legislation that may or may not actually benefit us. And in this case, I feel like this legislation does not truly benefit the broad disability community and that we were not consulted.
So let's talk about what it is that would be helpful for a disabled hiker. As you said, this isn't a monolith. The community has broad needs. But what have you found in your own experience? Like if paved roads are not, the most useful thing in the world, what would be?
Yeah, so I think really just investing in the infrastructure that we already have, making sure that trails are maintained, that amenities are maintained, and that accessible recreation opportunities are provided. So things like, installing benches on trails, making more access available for motorized wheelchairs and other powered adaptive devices can be really useful. So there's already so much infrastructure that is out there that if we just invested in that, it would have a huge impact.
That's interesting. So is this an area in which you think legislation is necessary? Like, is there anything you advocate for, or is a lot of this already covered in the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Yeah, a lot of it is covered in the Americans with Disabilities Act as well as the Architectural Barriers Act. And currently there's the Explore Act that has passed the House and is in the Senate right now. And that act will actually both allow the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management to increase roads and allow more opportunities for motorized recreation, as well as mandate that accessibility assessments are done for all trails and that more accessible recreation opportunities are created. So there's all of this work is already happening.
Let me ask you about your own experience in this and kind of what led you to do this work. I mean, you have published guides for disabled hikers about, places you can go and things that are accessible. What does accessibility look like in the outdoors? Is it different than, in a building or an office or a school?
Absolutely. And, again, there's a variety of access needs that are out there. So, in the information and the guides that I write, I really try to just assess the all of the details that are present in on the trail or in that recreation site so that people can make their own decisions because access needs are so varied. So things like, trail surface and grade and obstacles all come into play on whether a trail will be accessible or not, as well as things like benches and restrooms and water fountains. All of those amenities can also have an impact on whether someone can enjoy that space.
Do you think that lots of people who are disabled still feel like the outdoors are not accessible to them or not a place that they belong?
Sadly, yes, yeah. And a large part of that is because so many spaces are inaccessible, but also that there's just a real lack of information out there about how to enjoy the outdoors as a disabled person and how to find the information that you need to decide whether or not that space will be accessible for you. So that's something that we're really trying to work on.
When we talk about laws that already exist, the Americans with Disabilities Act, this Explore Act you mentioned that's working its way through the legislative process, is it also about enforcement or, I guess, lack of enforcement?
Enforcement is a huge issue. The Americans with Disabilities Act really does not have an enforcement arm. It's reliant upon disabled people to make complaints, and then those complaints may or may not be acted upon. So there's really no enforcement mechanism that is embedded into these acts. And then also, I mean, of course, legislation and all of that is important, but there can often be a huge disconnect between that and what is actually happening on the ground. So, training for people who are interacting with the public, making sure that, disability communities are consulted as this work is being implemented is incredibly important.
Let me ask you a kind of a broader question lastly, just about the trajectory of this, right? Like, you're doing this work and it sounds like you still feel like there's a lot of work to be done in this arena. But do you think that we need a broader shift in the way that, especially, you know, national parks, these government run places that are, you know, supposed to be our gateways to the great outdoors are approached so that it is accessible to people, and not just accessible, but welcoming?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think one key to that is making it easier for community organizations such as ours to have those connections and to approach these national agencies and for them to be able to work with us. You know, there's such a wealth of information that is available in our communities that if it were easier to kind of get through that bureaucratic process, that would open up a huge avenue.
All right. That is Siren Nagakiri, founder and director of the nonprofit Disabled Hikers. Siren, thank you for coming on. Thanks for your perspective here.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll hear from an Arizona children's book author on what inspired her to write about the Verde River.
We ended up getting a pop-up and spending the night there and watching the beautiful stars at night and listening to the owls. And just sitting by the river was when I was inspired to write on the Verde River.
She's now headed to the National Book Festival in D.C. next month to represent Arizona. But first, early voting is underway in advance of the state's July 30th primary, and in some races, the winner of this month's contest will win the seat, either because there's no opponent from the other party, or the party registration in a district is so heavily tilted to one side or the other that the other side has virtually no chance to win. The Arizona Republic recently published an unsigned editorial encouraging primary voters to choose competence over conspiracy and to pick serious candidates who have well-thought-out views on the issues. Elvia Diaz is the paper's editorial page editor, and she joins me to talk more about this. And Elvia, what prompted you and your colleagues to write this editorial?
Well, you know what? This election is incredibly important, and you will hear that in every election, right? But we have seen that the primary, it is a key election where a lot of the races are going to be decided, and that's because how the districts have been drawn and, you know, the voter registration. So it is important to take a stand. You know, we do not, as an institutional voice, endorse candidates that was decided a while back, you know, a few years ago. But this time as a group, we felt it is incredibly important to tell voters to take a stand, especially on these races in the primary that are going to be decided right there. So that's going to be the key vote. And specifically, we decided to focus on the Republican Party, which, you know, we indicate there in the editorial that still holds, you know, about 243,000 voter registration advantage over Democrats. Yet the party has been run by MAGA loyalists in the past few years. And that's incredibly concerning. We also note in the editorial that the Republican Party, MAGA essentially, have turned on their own. And they have censored everyone that you can think of that does not follow their line. And we're talking about Governor Doug Ducey, Senator McCain, Cindy McCain, former Senator Jeff Flake, you know, the Speaker of the House, County Attorney Rachel Mitchell, and all the justices of the Supreme Court. So we felt it is important to remind voters what is at stake and, you know, to look at a specific races and really illustrate the quality of the candidates that are there and that they are very hard to find in these primaries.
So it seems as though what you're suggesting maybe goes against the conventional wisdom a little bit on both sides of the aisle, which is that the candidates who tend to come out of primaries are those either, you know, the voters are, you know, those who are very passionate either on the left or on the right, sort of on the maybe not centrist parts of that spectrum. I wonder if this becomes a difficult task for, you know, to ask voters to not vote for the candidates furthest to the left or furthest to the right, given who, you know, tends to vote in the primaries.
Well, I mean, that's a hard part, but also not so much in some of the districts that when we're talking about competitive districts, what you are asking makes total sense because you would want people to vote the best candidates to come out of the primary and face in the general elections. And this editorial, we were focusing on the races and the districts that are going to be decided in the primary. For instance, Congressional District 8. There's no such thing as a competitive race here, and getting the best one here to face a Democrat, for instance, that's not going to happen. And the same thing on some state races and county races.
Yeah, I'm curious if this sort of goes across the board. I mean, there are a number of races in the state legislature where the winner of the primary is either definitely assured to win because there is no opponent on the other side, or probably going to win because the districts are so strongly tilted in favor of one party or the other. Does your argument that you're using in CD8 kind of apply across the board to all of those races?
Yes, that's exactly it. You got it. I mean, you have, for instance, in the say Senate, Legislative District 17, and the county races for supervisors, they're mostly Republicans, not very competitive. So some of those races are going to be decided in the primary. And again, this editorial, we focus on the Republicans, but we will come back with other editorials. This morning, for instance, we published one focus in just in the state legislature, and then on other races, you know, on the Democratic side, congressional district. Oh my goodness, I'm forgetting the number now. I believe it is 3. The two Democrats who wants to replace Representative Ruben Gallego,
yeah, who's District
running
3
for Senate. Yes. So whoever wins in the primary is it. So there are only two Democrats running there, Raquel Terán and Yasemin Ansari. So same thing applies for the Democrats, right? I mean, there's no competition there in the general election. So that's why it's going to be important to highlight those in the primary. But again, that they are more in the Republican side, at least that I can see, that are going to be decided in the primary.
What will you be looking for? I mean, early voting has begun. So what will you be looking for between now and, you know, maybe the days before the primary, based on what the candidates are doing, to determine if maybe what you're calling on primary voters to do is actually happening?
Well, we're looking that a lot of TV ads are happening right now. Mailers are being sent out. And, you know, all candidates are going to be redoubling their efforts, but especially on these races that are going to be decided in the primary. Unfortunately, the state of politics is just going to be attack, attack, attack your opponent and your opponents. And that's what we're going to be looking at. I'll be looking at that and see, you know, who's lying, who's stretching the truth, and, you know, try to tell voters that. Now, again, voting is already underway. The primary is July 30th. So we will see a lot of money being spent on some of these races and just, you know, doubling and tripling their efforts to either lie or to exaggerate things, which is most unfortunate, instead of talking about the issue. So it is our responsibility as the media, not just to amplify those messages, which we tend to do, and look at the issues, looking about what are voters thinking about other than immigration. You know, clearly people are concerned about the economy, are concerned about jobs, are concerned about education, about vouchers, what's happening here in the state. But those issues are not sexy, right? I mean, they don't really tell voters to you know, make a decision on that again, which is unfortunate, but it is a responsibility to at least try to navigate that and try to remind readers what's at stake here.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic. Elvia, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Native American art has for a long time been confined to a certain sector of the art world, craft, niche, maybe touristy. The same could be said for fiber arts. But our next guest is taking both of those things and putting them on the walls at New York's Museum of Modern Art. Melissa Cody is a fourth-generation Navajo weaver, and her latest show, Webbed Skies, will be on display at MoMA through September. Her work is both traditional and modern, exploring everything from uranium mining on the Navajo reservation to the pixelated video games she grew up playing. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
Let's start with a little bit about this moment that you're in, right? Like, this is a big deal to have a show at MoMA, and kind of a big deal not just for you, but it sounds like for women in fiber art in general, maybe for Indigenous art in general, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I've been weaving since I was 5 years old, so it's exciting to see more, one, female artists, but also, you know, Indigenous artists who are making waves and kind of breaking out from, you know, the little Indian art kind of bubble, mm-hmm. and really mm-hmm. having a lot of, you know, exposure on a national scale, and also being able to, you know, just have such a wide range of audience.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of this, about your own history in this. Like, I think lots of folks know about Navajo weaving and kind of have an idea of what it looks like. But you're a fourth generation weaver, is that right? You grew up, you said, since the age of five doing this?
Yeah, I learned from my mother, but I have a large extended family. So a lot of, you know, my aunts and cousins and my other grandmas, they, you know, were all very much visible, you know, as artists in their own way growing up. So I really had a, you know, a large community behind me who was just kind of rooting for me to begin with. So, you know, being again on like a wide platform now, that, you know, energy is still carrying me on.
That's really cool. Tell us a little bit about the kind of traditional Navajo designs you started creating when you were learning, and the way that your work has evolved over the years, which I know has been through, you know, many different versions. But there seems to be some kind of experimenting that you do now where you combine contemporary themes with traditional Navajo design.
Yeah, when I started weaving, you know, I learned kind of like the foundational regional patterns, you know, the traditional designs with, you know, serrated diamonds and really bold imagery with heavy geometric styles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was very much so influenced by my mother, who does these incredible textiles that are heavily detailed and really focusing on being excellent in terms of the technical quality. So the foundation was laid very early on to really strive to push yourself while you're at the loom. And so, you know, having that background really allowed me to kind of like take the reins when I was ready to start experimenting and bringing in my own personal flair to it. Mm-hmm. And that was probably around the late 90s and then early 2000s when I went to college in Santa Fe, New Mexico at the Institute of American Indian Arts. And so, you know, just being exposed to other mediums just kind of really opened my eyes in terms of looking at fiber art and textile it from like a different lens, and really being able to, you know, open myself up to, you know, self-critique and being able to find, you know, a voice behind each textile that I create.
So I know in the past you've had work focused on water issues, on uranium mining and the health impacts of that in your community. You're now kind of working in, and the show at MoMA is a lot about the influence of like 80s video games. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, again, you know, having all of these different perspectives, I really wanted to start creating like kind of capsule bodies of work where I'm really going in depth and exploring the different themes. And at that time when I was looking at the area that I'm from on the reservation, you know, that was a big issue, was the uranium mining that had happened and the lack of cleanup that, you know, it never took place, mm-hmm. and how it was affecting not only, you know, the wider community, but also my family. So a lot of these issues, you know, really hit home. So I wanted to explore and use my art to have a voice behind these issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of still having the influence of like technology and the video games, the more recent body of work is kind of coming full circle because, you know, working with the Jacquard loom and it being its own type of technology, mm-hmm. I'm really trying to explore a heavy theme is all of these kind of foundational inspirations. And looking at, you know, the video games and the 8-bit pixel, I really wanted to highlight, you know, the pixel quality and really explore the technology that I've grown up. You know, I started with, you know, Atari, the first Nintendo system, and Super Nintendo, being introduced to the first cell phones, you know, and also growing up, you know, without the internet, and now being in a heavily technology driven world. These are all things that I, you know, I still want to explore.
So talk a little bit about Jacquard, because this is, when you say a whole different type of technology, it is in a way that I'm not even sure I understand. I think we can kind of picture what a large scale loom looks like and how that work goes. But this is a different thing that you're doing a little bit, right?
Yeah, I'm still using a lot of the imagery that I do in my hand woven pieces. But being able to revisit, you know, some of the patterning that I had done maybe 10, 15 years ago and you know, feeding it into computer software and being able to manipulate the geometrics into like really complex configurations that I wouldn't be able to, you know, hand weave on a traditional Navajo loom.
Yeah.
It, again, it's like opening my creativity up into like a whole nother scope of what can I do? Mm-hmm. And it's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's super cool. So do you think that the public, like the broader, the art world's perspective on this kind of textile art and on Navajo weaving in particular is also changing in that? Like, are you at the forefront of that?
I believe so. A lot of it is bringing about conversation, you know, craft versus fine art, you know, Indian art versus modern art. How do we classify ourselves in terms of being indigenous artists and kind of like taking the reins of telling our own stories and having our own voices, whether it's, you know, how we put our artwork out into the market or how is it being, you know, seen within a gallery or museum context. So really being open to conversation has been, I think, a big, big influence in terms of, you know, elevating the work and bringing it to a wider audience where there is more conversation around Navajo textiles and, you know, where they are going into the future. Because I think when, especially I think Native art is talked about, it can be kind of restricted into, it's kind of frozen in time. You have this idea of what traditional Navajo weaving is. Mm. And so for me to be weaving these, you know, super elaborate textiles and this, you know, bright electric color palette and really bringing it into like a current age, I think it brings about this idea that, you know, we're ever evolving people and the art also evolves with us.
Well, all right, we'll leave it there then. That is Melissa Cody, an artist, fourth generation Navajo weaver. Her show Webbed Sky will be on display at MoMA until September 9th. Melissa, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about your work. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Leaders of NATO countries are taking part in a summit meeting in Washington, D.C. this week. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. And Jonathan, what can we expect to see from this gathering?
Well, this is Jens Stoltenberg's final summit as the organization's Secretary General. He'll be handing over to the former Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, later this year. Jens Stoltenberg has said that this week's event is going to focus on three areas: boosting Allied defense and deterrence, supporting Ukraine in its defense against Russia's invasion, and also strengthening the organization's global partnerships with a focus on the Indo-Pacific. Now, the organization has made progress in recent years in boosting defense spending among its members. The target is to spend 2% of GDP on defense, though some of the organization's members spend significantly more than that. Poland tops the league on around 3.9% of GDP. That's ahead of yourselves in the US even, which spends around 3.5% of GDP on defense. A number of countries are still below the 2% target, including France and Germany, and that's despite calls for the defense spending target to be increased to 2.5 or even 3%. So there might be some movement on that. As regards Ukraine, Jens Stoltenberg told President Zelensky in meetings last month that Ukraine would be top of the agenda. And this summit comes as a Russian missile attack on Ukraine today has left dozens of people dead. However, it is thought that Ukraine is unlikely to receive a formal invitation to join the alliance, which is something the country has long been pressing for, though NATO did pledge at its Vilnius summit that, quote, Ukraine's future is in NATO.
Interesting. All right, Jonathan, let's talk about a couple of elections in Western Europe. Obviously, you in the UK had a big one last week. The NATO summit we were just talking about, that will be the new Prime Minister Keir Starmer's first stop on the world stage. But Parliament will be meeting for the first time since that election tomorrow. What are you expecting to see from the new government there in the UK?
Well, it's been quite a remarkable 6 or 7 weeks here since Rishi Sunak made an announcement setting the election date for last Thursday, and it all ended up giving Keir Starmer's Labour Party a huge majority, though analysts were quick to point out that Keir Starmer's victory didn't see an increase in vote share compared to the last election in 2019. Instead, the prominence of Nigel Farage's anti-immigration Reform UK party took significant votes from the Conservatives, meaning Rishi Sunak's party effectively lost the vote. But that said, it's a historic victory for Labour. And the net loss of seats for the Conservatives was its highest at an election in the party's history. Now, throughout the campaign, Labour outlined what it called its 6 first steps. And I think we'll see fairly quick action on those, which include a key focus on trying to deliver economic stability, working to provide 40,000 National Health Service appointments each week with a view to cutting the historically high waiting lists that are currently in place for treatment. There'll be a big focus on planning reform to enable house building. There have been some announcements setting targets back in place for house building with a view to making homes more affordable. And there's also an ambition to recruit 6,500 new teachers and launch a new border security command with the aim of stopping gangs in France from arranging small boat crossings. This is one of the most significant topics in the election and is Labour's alternative to the Conservatives' plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda for their claims to be processed there. That scheme was summarily abandoned over the weekend. Meanwhile, the Conservative Party, now in opposition for the first time in 14 years, is trying to work out next steps to replace Rishi Sunak as leader. And there's likely to be a big internal debate over whether to choose someone from the right of the party to try and head off the threat from the Reform UK party or tack to the centre to compete with Keir Starmer's Labour.
And speaking of France, Jonathan, there were elections there as well. Final results of parliamentary elections in France have been coming in, and Marine Le Pen's National Rally Party performed much worse than polls expected. They expected that her party would do quite well there. What happens now?
Well, that's right. The far-right National Rally has come in third place. It's a remarkable turnaround from where things were a week ago after the first round of voting, which saw the party top the polls, though only favoured by around a third of voters. There were initial projections last week that National Rally's Jordan Bardella could be set to become the next prime minister, but a round of deal-making between the left-wing New Popular Front and President Emmanuel Macron's Ensemble Alliance, where in many cases, whichever of the two candidates came in third place stood down before the second round of voting yesterday, meant that voters were faced with the choice of National Rally or one candidate from the centre or left. The left-wing alliance New Popular Front came through in first place, pushing Emmanuel Macron's Ensemble into second place, leaving National Rally in third place and unable to form a government. But nobody can form a government. So what happens now is that there's likely to be a period involving quite a bit of uncertainty as some sort of coalition is sought to take France forward. As I say, no group has enough seats to govern by itself. Now, Prime Minister Gabriel Attal is resigning, though Emmanuel Macron has asked him to stay on until a successor is chosen. He said that none of the extremes can claim a majority and says for this he credits the French spirit. Meanwhile, Marine Le Pen says her party's victory, quote, has only been delayed, adding that she sees the seeds of tomorrow's victory in today's results. So we can now expect to see, as I say, a period of haggling over an eventual coalition forming around an as yet undefined programme of government. And the left, flush from their strong performance, will expect a very strong voice, I suspect.
Interesting. All right, Jonathan, finally, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is on a 2-day visit to Russia this week. That'll be today and tomorrow. What are you looking for there?
Well, this is Narendra Modi's first visit to Russia since 2019, but Russia and India have had strong ties with each other since the Cold War, and India's significance as a key trading partner has only grown since Vladimir Putin launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine back in early 2022. Alongside China, India has become a key purchaser of Russian oil in the wake of sanctions imposed by the West, which essentially shut off most Western markets for Russian exports. But Narendra Modi has been towing a careful line on Ukraine. He's avoided condemning Russia's action in Ukraine, while at the same time calling for a peaceful settlement to the conflict. Meanwhile, on landing in Moscow, Narendra Modi spoke on social media about a special and privileged partnership between Russia and India. And there has been some tension between Moscow and New Delhi since Russia started developing closer ties with India's key rival China as a result of the hostilities in Ukraine. That's partly down to tensions between India and China over a Himalayan border dispute, which has flared up a couple of times in recent years. And just last week, Narendra Modi skipped a summit of a security grouping known as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that had been created by China and Russia to counter Western alliances. Instead, India's foreign minister went along to the gathering that was attended by both Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you too.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Later this summer, children's author Phoebe Fox will be one of the writers representing Arizona at the National Book Festival in Washington, D.C. Fox's latest book, On the Verde River, takes the form of a poem illustrated by watercolor illustrations done by her father-in-law. The book encourages readers to stop, take a deep breath, and notice the sights, sounds, and abundant forms of life that thrive along the riverbed. Fox recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about her inspirations for the book and why she loves writing books for children in particular.
Back in 2018, my husband and I acquired some land in Camp Verde on the Verde River, and it was very rough, and we started spending a lot of time there. And we realized that it was also a great opportunity with our boys to teach them about how do you take care of land, how do you take care of the river, and look at all the things we can do outside. So we ended up getting a pop-up and spending the night there and watching the beautiful stars at night and listening to the owls. And just sitting by the river was when I was inspired to write On the Verde River.
I couldn't help noticing there's a couple of pages, I guess, where you bring humans into the narrative. We see a group of people with their pickup truck parked next to the river, having a campfire. There's also folks in a fishing boat. I know that part of the goal of the book is to raise awareness about the dangers that human activities pose to the river's ecosystem. So how did you think about the choice to include people in the story?
Interesting question. I think that from what I know about writing children's books, you always need to have some sort of a story. So the idea that a family is there camping in the beginning, and then they go throughout the course of the day. You see a little boy up in the tree looking down at some of the things in the river. You see a man and a dog fishing, the family watching the stars and the moon rise at the end. Those are all things that my family has been fortunate enough to do on the Verde River. And I hope that people will be inspired to spend time on the Verde, but at the same time, appreciate it and take care of it.
On your YouTube channel, which is called Mama Fox Books, you have this recurring series called Storytime Saturdays, where you read children's books, your own and others. And as I was watching those, I thought, you know, not all writers like telling stories mm-hmm. out loud, but you seem to really relish it. What do you like about it?
I love reading to kids, and it benefits kids who might not get a story time otherwise. During the pandemic, it was really important to me to keep those story times coming so that kids who normally would go to the library and hear a librarian read to them were getting something at home.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I've also just always had a passion for children's books. You know, my mom and dad read to us a lot. I collected them starting in college when I was getting my degree in education.
You did?
Yeah, I have a huge collection, and if they're signed, that's even better.
What were your favorite ones growing up?
Oh, I love Margaret Wise Brown. So, of course, everyone loves Goodnight Moon, but her writing is so beautiful to me. I loved Dr. Seuss.
Uh-huh.
Michelle Silverstein always made me laugh.
What made you start collecting them in college? Was it because you were doing scholarly work about them, or did you just like having them around?
I think it was both.
Uh-huh.
Probably my favorite class was children's literature.
Uh-huh.
So that might have been when I started collecting them, but I already had my childhood books because
mm-hmm.
my mom kept them for us. Each book had, you know, our names in it, but also who gave it to us and the year. And I love that. I do that for my kids too, so I can see how long I've had the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember going to the Changing Hands on Mill because I went to ASU. and picking out some children's books there and just starting the collection. I knew I was going to either teach or do something that involved children's books. I just wasn't sure quite what at that point.
Yeah, I mean, you're making me, I was not planning for us to talk about this, but you're making me think about the way that books that you have when you're a kid feel like more than books.
Experiences, almost.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I think about how some people talk about music and how you are immediately brought back to a moment when you hear a song, I feel the same way about picture books. You know, when I read a book that I loved as when I was a child to my kids or my nieces and nephews who are much younger than my kids, I'm brought back to that moment when I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really wonderful that way.
I remember going to the library at my elementary school after our teacher read us the BFG for the first time.
Oh, Roald Dahl was one of my favorites.
Yeah. I mean, that book, I had just never heard anything like the way he used language. And there were two copies of the BFG in the library, and I checked them both out. Because
oh.
I just wanted to have as much BFG as I
wow.
could. I don't know.
Oh my goodness, that's a great story.
What I was thinking, but
I remember that word frobscottle.
Frobscottle.
That was
yes.
great.
Yes, whiz poppers.
Yeah, whiz poppers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wrote to him in fourth grade. We were supposed to choose an author to write to. I don't know if my letter got to him in England, but I never heard back. And I thought, you know, if I ever get a chance, I'm going to write back.
Uh-huh. Wow.
I was reading Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator at the time.
Mm.
There are so many good ones.
Oh, yes. The Vermicious Knids.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Going back to you sharing your work on your YouTube page, the thing that struck me about the fact that you did that, that feels related to, you know, what we associate with these authors that we love so much, is that you're sort of giving your work away. Like there's this generosity to it. How did you think about that?
The way I look at it is that when you're a kid and you like a children's book, you're not going to want to hear it just one time.
Yeah.
You're going to say, I love that one. And let's get it right now. And mom, can you please take me to the library at this very moment
yeah.
and pick it out or to the store or, you know, the bookstore. And so I hope that when kids listen to the book being read to them, that they'll find that they love it and that they will want to get it.
Right. They want to have that relationship with it that we were talking about of like,
mm-hmm.
no, that's my time machine. That's my teleportation
yeah.
device
yeah.
to this world I like being in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I also I was very moved by what you said about some kids who might not be able to have a story time. Going back to what you said about your parents reading you children's books when you were growing up, do you remember what you liked about that experience when you were a kid of being read to?
I think it was mostly the one-on-one feeling that you get, that time spent together. For me, it was the experience of being next to my mom or dad, or even my big sister who would read to me sometimes, and having that coziness, but also getting to experience something that I just naturally loved. I had an appreciation for it when I was little, and hearing the prose or rhyme and seeing the illustrations, I think that it's really unique that you can't have a children's book without one piece or the other. And you need those illustrations to tell part of the story. And it's difficult sometimes as a writer to hold back and not describe everything in the text. But you have to always keep in mind that the illustration is going to tell half the story.
Well, Phoebe Fox, author of On the Verde River, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a treat.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.